This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 85. Today we welcome Mark Knoll to discuss the new shape of world Christianity. Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we want to thank everyone who helps to make this program possible. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/support. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I have with me today Daryl G. Hart, who's noted historian and author, most recently of A Secular Faith, Why Christianity Favors the Separation of Church and State. And he also writes over at oldlife.org, which is part of the Reform Forum Network. He's laughing as I mention that. It's great to have you on, Daryl. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, good to be here.
And our special guest today is Mark Knoll, who's Francis A. McEnany Professor of History at the University of Notre Dame. He's written several books, including The Civil War as a Theological Crisis, also The Rise of Evangelicalism, The Age of Edwards, Whitfield, and the Wesleys. But today we're going to be speaking about his new book, The New Shape of World Christianity. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Knoll. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
As I mentioned, we are very excited, and we are going to be speaking about the new shape of world Christianity, a very large topic, but one in which Dr. Knoll brings, I think, a pointed perspective on it and an interesting argument within. As we get started, I just wanted to ask, Dr. Knoll, this book seems to be, it is a very interesting book, but it seems to be just a little bit different from some of your previous books, focusing on missions and world Christianity rather than the history of Christianity in North America. What really got you started in this topic, and why did you want to write on world Christianity, moving outside of your typical domain?
Several years ago, I was in charge of teaching a one-semester history of Christianity course at Wheaton College, and it became more and more absurd to try to do that, particularly for the latter part where I think we had 2.5 weeks to go from the rise of Puritans to the present, so it just didn't work. And the idea was, well, we should divide this, and we did. And I was given the responsibility of teaching a more recent course, which eventually was called the History of Christianity since 1800, and then I think maybe since 1900. And it proved to be a very, very interesting assignment. Obviously, no one can master the history of recent world Christianity, but a lot of good writing and a lot of good work is being done. About the same time, maybe just a little bit later, I encountered the works of Andrew Walls, one of the great essayists of the current period. Andrew Walls, having had experience in Sierra Leone and Nigeria and other parts of Africa, as well as a few places in Asia, has written a number of very thought-provoking essays about the character of Christianity as always a cross-cultural movement. And these essays have been gathered into two books, and they were quite inspirational. Then I think maybe I would say just as a church person, it's obvious in all denominations and all parts of the U.S. and Canada that the churches from around the world are making a big impact in where we live. So we have in northern Indiana, where I live now, Vietnamese churches, Korean churches, a lot of Hispanic churches, churches from different parts of Africa, different parts of Asia. And it was just an interesting thing for somebody who works on the older history, more traditional history of Christianity to get involved in. I'm sort of forgetting the negotiations within the Varsity Press that led to the book we're talking about today, but somewhere that entered in too with friends who work in the Varsity Press and who this book is a result.
Now, your basic thesis, you're very upfront in the first chapter describing where you're going to go with this book, and I appreciated that, but now you argue that the key to understanding American Christianity's influence in world Christianity is understanding the shift and the changes that Christianity underwent when it moved from Europe to America.
Right.
Could you describe some of those basic forces? I know you detail this in the book, but I don't want to just sit here and read the book when we have you on the line. What were the main factors and the main things that changed when Christianity came from the continent over to the United States?
Well, the big change was the organization of Christian faith rather than Christian theology or Christian practice, at least in the early period. And the big change was that, particularly after the end of the 18th century in the United States, a little bit later in Canada, that churches would be driven by the voluntary activity of their members. Since the 4th and 5th century in Europe, there had been a widespread assumption that church life and the life of political organizations simply are interwoven, because God is the God of political life and God is the God of religious life. It just makes sense for the institutions of church and state to be interwoven. There were, of course, protests to this widespread and long-standing assumption, but the protests were pretty insignificant, and there weren't many people who took the protests very seriously. What exists in the United States de facto by the 18th century, and then de jure by the end of the 18th century and the 19th century, is stepping back from church life of governments in any kind of broad official sense. So if churches are going to flourish, they're going to have to flourish on the ability to recruit members, the ability to organize themselves, the ability to define the Christian faith as they receive it, and then get about living the Christian faith. This we take for granted in the United States just because it's been done for a couple hundred years, but it really was a terrific innovation in the late 18th, early 19th century. Europeans knew that Christianity would fall to the ground in the U.S. because it just wasn't being supported the way the churches always had been supported. But that didn't happen, and in their own way, in a distinctive way, and with some positive and some negative, church life in the United States flourished. And the basic argument of the book is that when people ask the question, how does the history of Christianity in the U.S. relate now to the history of Christianity in the world, the wrong place to look is for direct influence. Certainly, there are influences for good and for ill that come out of the United States for the churches around the world. But the main connection, I think, is that in the non-European parts of the world, certainly Africa and Asia, not so much Latin America for a different set of reasons, but in Asia and Africa, the churches are in a cultural, social setting much closer to what the U.S. churches experienced from the 19th century onward than was the case in Europe. That's basically the argument of the introduction and much of the book, and I try to expand upon it and flesh that out and ask what it means in different contexts.
Well, Mark, picking up on, given your interest in hymnody and Christian song, I wonder what you think of, and I don't know, this is an open-ended question, what sort of direct influence is there of American contemporary Christian music on world Christianity? I mean, is that one place where you could see perhaps a direct influence more? Granted, languages would have to change, but I've heard that a lot of the music sung in contemporary settings here is also sung around the world.
Right. The question of music in church or music used by Christians is a really interesting one because it has many different dimensions. I remember taking two trips that were sponsored by organizations at Wheaton College to Romania in 1989 and 1991. 1989 is before the fall of communism, and the churches operated under a lot of pressure. And in the churches, there was the most wonderful traditional singing. They call it carols, not Christmas carols, but a caroling is a traditional Romanian way of singing that actually drew from some Orthodox things, but it also developed in the Protestant churches. In a very bleak and unpromising situation, this music was just wonderful. 2 years later, we were back, and at least the churches we went to, people had electronic synthesizers standing in front of microphones and were singing the American Christian contemporary music things, which seemed to me a really interesting development that had some difficulties. Certainly the worldwide communications, electronic media like podcasts make it possible for a church like Hillsong in Sydney, Australia to have its music, which is freshly produced, available all around the world. And as previously non-connected parts of the non-Western world are connected to the Western world, then places of central electronic authority have a huge influence. So I'm just sure that the popular music that prevails in many American churches also prevails in churches around the world just because of modern communication. But there's other dimensions of this story. Korean Protestant churches sing a lot of hymnody that sounds like late 1800s, early 1900s gospel songs. I've asked Koreans now, are these translations? And in some cases they are, but in many other cases they are Korean-originated music chosen for Korean reasons. It sounds an awful lot like Rescue the Perishing and To God Be the Glory and other standards that entered Protestant music, church music in North America in the late 19th century. So that's another way in which you could say, well, is that an American style being imposed upon the Koreans? Is American style taken up by the Koreans? Just as, how does that work? Then, however, there's a completely different direction. There are organizations associated with Wycliffe that specialize in ethnomusicological examination of new Christian groups, and that actually promote the use of indigenous musical forms, most of which don't sound even musical by Western standards, as a vehicle for expressing Christian truth. Wycliffe has worked with these ethnomusicologists in many parts around the world now, often to encourage new groups of indigenous Christians simply to set newly translated scriptures to music. I've heard a CD of this music. It's incomprehensible to me by anything Western, but it has been effective, I've been told, and fairly reliable sources. It's been effective in some kind of dramatic outreach of the Christian presence. In other words, where the Bible is translated, there's some impact of Christianity, where the churches in new Christian areas sing translated Western hymns, there's a little bit of effect. Where the scriptures are put into the indigenous music of the particular place, there's sometimes dramatic expansion of Christianity. And at least the CD that I had put out by one of these groups had about 40 examples of this new kind of music. And apart from some Estonian music, it actually sounded pretty Western. Almost all of it was just not what you'd get on any radio station in North America or any Christian publisher or secular publisher, but apparently very effective. So that's a terrific question, and it has to do with globalization as a media matter, globalization as a funding matter, but also globalization of Christian faith as a translation matter, which can be in form, musical form, as well as in words.
It sounds a little bit like the Hudson Taylor Project, if I remember my history correctly. Was he the missionary to China, if I'm correct, who actually started to dress as the Chinese?
Right, right. I mean, there were, in the 19th century, until European imperialism took over, there were a number of ventures that tried to go as far as possible in adapting Christian form to indigenous content. Hudson Taylor was certainly one. Henry Venn of the Church Missionary Society was another. John Nevius, the American missionary in China. All of these groups were in their own way, I think, sort of following in the path of the Jesuits and other Catholics who had been doing that since the 16th and 17th century in China, North America, and other parts of the world. But those groups, Catholic and Protestant, were thinking about questions of culture and what it is what's necessary for the Christian faith. One of the terrific things about the essays of Andrew Walls is that he's written about these matters with real profundity, and to make arguments about what is and is not essential when you have a cross-cultural communication of the Christian faith. But yes, Hudson Taylor was certainly a 19th century pioneer in saying that much of our Western Christian expression, however proper and appropriate and useful in the West, is not helpful outside of the West, and it's appropriate to take on some of the characteristics of the culture in which you're trying to communicate the gospel. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting point, but it sounds as though it's a little bit antagonistic to what you found and what you express in the book, the fact that Hudson Taylor and many others are trying to contextualize into the culture. But what happened in colonialization, but then also what we seem to be finding in world Christianity today, is it's taking on the same shape, or at least the same trends as America underwent. It's taking on the same forms due to globalization.
Yes, although I see happening around the world most directly is not an imitation of what went on in America, but an imitation of the organization, necessarily, although there is some of that, certainly. But what's happening is an imitation of the organization of churches, and the key thing is the voluntary activity. So in that sense, it is an imitation of what happened in America, but the voluntary organization of churches in many parts of the world where, say, the Bible has just been recently translated, can lead, as I mentioned, to this kind of singing and indigenous musical forms that could not be more different from what happens in American churches.
One thing I found very interesting in Chapter 4 of your book is this concentration of U.S. power view. And you argue that it's really not helpful, even if you have a positive view of it or a negative view. Could you describe what is meant by this concentration of U.S. power and how that's impacted missiology?
Well, I think there is a pair of approaches to world Christianity coming out of North America, Western Europe, that share a general attitude. The general attitude is that the churches around the world are following the churches of North America and Western Europe. The negative way of putting that is that the churches of North America and Western Europe are dictating to, in some ways, corrupting and destroying the local life. That was a point of view very widely shared in kind of the heyday of Marxist imperial studies in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But then there is the corresponding Christian view that sees Western missionaries as more or less the key thing in the gospel all around the world. And what I'm trying to suggest in the book is that while in fact there is influence coming out of Western Europe, coming out of North America for Christianity around the globe, the really important thing for the new places where Christianity is taking root is what takes place in those local areas. Here I draw on the work of Laman Sana, the distinguished historian of actually Islam and world Christianity at the Yale Divinity School of the Yale History Department, who has developed theoretically and practically the notion of translation. And Sana's argument is that once the Bible is translated into local languages and local cultural idioms, then the agents who bring the Christian message, the agents who bring the translation, recede in importance, and the ones who become very important in saying what that message means to the people in the local region. And I think that's exactly right. There's just many, many examples in both Catholic and Protestant history where the Bible translators worked very hard to translate the scriptures in order to give something to the people they were working with. The people they were working with took the translated scriptures and made something of them somewhat different than the missionaries intended. And that process, it has been ongoing. It actually was ongoing back in the classical Christian history of Europe and North America, but it continues today. So what I'm arguing against is any kind of notion that for good or for ill, what Western people want to have take place in the West, rest of the world has a limited influence.
To tie this book into your book on the Reformation and is the Reformation over, and I'm curious if there is much anti-Catholicism that you see in global Christianity, if we want to call it that, and given how the relevant similarities between this modern form of Christianity, because Roman Catholicism certainly in the 19th century was identified with the past and with tradition, and
right.
So anti-Catholicism was part of an anti-traditional cast to Protestantism. Do Protestant Roman Catholic tensions make any sense in the new landscape?
Yes, and that's a really good question for getting at differences in the rest of the world. I think one of the deficits in my book, probably, and deficits in my thinking, is that I can see many strands of different forms of Christian faith in the West, but then I look beyond the West and I think of non-Western Christianity. Well, of course, there isn't any one thing that's non-Western Christianity. So on this question of anti-Catholicism, the reality in Central and Latin America is that anti-Catholicism is pretty much the essence of much of the new vitality of Protestant, Pentecostal, and post-Protestant groups. The antagonisms between Protestants and Catholics are not quite as strong in many parts of Latin and Southern America as they were, say, even 20 years ago. Much of the new and sometimes very vital Pentecostal Christianity in Central and Latin America is being carried forward by people who just equate Catholicism with that which is dead and merely formal and an encumbrance. So in that part of the world, I think Protestant anti-Catholicism is probably much stronger than it has become in Europe and in North America. In Africa and Asia, I'm not sure that I'd want to bet the mortgage on this generalization, but I'm pretty sure that Catholic-Protestant tensions are less and less sharply focused than in the U.S. and Canada and Northern Europe. I'm aware of some things happening in Chinese cities, some things happening in a few African places where there is either cooperation between Catholics and Protestants as if they're just two different denominations, or where there is, in fact, a separation between Catholic Christianity and Protestant forms of Christianity, but a separation without the history of antagonisms and ideological defense and attack and apologetic that has characterized the West. We had a Notre Dame student who came back from Uganda not too long ago, and I asking her about these kind of things. She was working with both Catholic and Anglican, and she said, "Well, the big difference there is the Anglicans don't drink, and they don't think you should drink." And I said, "Well, how about theology?" And I said, "Well, I'm not aware of the theology." So maybe there was. And we had a nice talk by a Catholic cardinal from Uganda later in the year, and he told about the efforts he'd undertaken to help bring about peace with the Lord's Resistance Army in the northern part of Uganda. And much of the effort that he engaged in for that purpose was undertaken in close cooperation with the main Anglican bishop, who would have been a very evangelical person, in Uganda. And the fact that these were two separate traditions in Western Christianity didn't seem to enter into the picture. So where you do not have a continuous history, where the history of your church begins 30, 50, 100 years ago, I just don't think there's the same dynamic between Catholics and Protestants that exists willy-nilly in the West that we've experienced.
Well, let me push it then in the other direction to see if you think, put on your prophet's hat, and to see if you think in the same way that there was a fundamentalist-modernist controversy because the modernists were modernizing too quickly, because you're describing this current Christianity as a modern one, very, very much driven by modernity, is the sort of liberalism that we saw in the early 20th century, for instance, coming in this other form of Christianity? And is there potential for another kind of, or for a fundamentalist reaction that modernity should only go so far, modernization of Christianity should only go so far?
Yeah, no, that modernity, of course, is a plastic
right.
notion, and what we've clearly seen in the worldwide Anglican community is that Anglicans from Singapore and Latin America and Africa think that British and Dutch, British and Canadian, American, Anglican, Episcopalianism has gone too fast, too far in a modern direction to get a reaction. I think you're asking about modernization in the non-Western world.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would follow some of what Philip Jenkins has argued, that most of the expanding religious communities outside of the West are not really threatened by modernism or Western style liberalism. Certainly there is an element where people coming from the newer Christian regions to the West for education have received modern or liberal or radical ideas. In Korea, for example, the Minjun theology, I think, was probably a Korean adaptation of things learned in Geneva and Chicago and Tübingen. But it seems to me that much more prevalent, much more prominent is the question of God's immediate action, and the fact that so much of the newer Christian world looks Pentecostal, and it's called Pentecostal or not, but looks Pentecostal, says to me that a more critical question might actually, in some situations, divide Christian believers. Is just what is conviction? What is the conviction about how directly and how immediately God works with his people?
Mm-hmm.
And many of the new Christian regions of the world have the translated New Testament. They read the book of Acts. They conclude what happened there is normative. It should be happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And head for encounters where God's power is manifest. These are regions where often the religion of the past is one where divine powers are manifest as well. In many cases, communities, individuals turn to Christ because Christ defeats the powers. And this defeat is not a metaphorical one or a psychological one, but it's right out there in the healing of body and the restoration of peace in the community. And obviously that emphasis, I think, is startling for Western Christians, even the charismatic and Pentecostal denominations in the West, where I think there's been a lot more theology, a lot more routinization of charisma as expected in the non-Western world.
The one thing that's interesting about the work of Philip Jenkins, a lot of people who read his books, especially Next Christendom, may not be aware, and I'm a longtime reader of The New Republic, that he also writes journalistic pieces for The New Republic. And his book, The Next Christendom, I think portrayed a pretty positive view of global Christianity as being a pretty authentic and sincere expression, and also a rival to Christianity in the West, which is, he saw, in some sort of decay. And yet some of the pieces he's written for The New Republic have suggested that some of the African forms of Christianity have been taking a more hardline view, say, on marriage and monogamous marriage in order to compete with the Muslims. So it's just an interesting
little
take on
what
Jenkins does and for whom he's writing. So
Right. I think Jenkins' work is interesting because he doesn't really pretend to be doing first-level scholarship, but his reach is very wide, and he takes in an awful lot of stuff that's publicly available. And he is concerned about Christian-Muslim tension,
uh-huh.
which is a real fact in the world, in places where both Islamic and Christian communities are emerging out of earlier primal religions. I used to like his the second book on world Christianity a little bit better than the first one, even. I'm forgetting the title, but it's the one where he talks about how the non-Western people put the Bible to use, and what he has there is a whole range of examples, some of which are scary and seem quite heretical, and some are just simply new and startling and very thought-provoking in how emphases in the Bible that certainly don't get preached about much in my Christian Reformed Church are front and center in some parts of the world.
You have mentioned already the shape that world Christianity seems to take is the Pentecostal shape. And this ties in, interesting, with this example that you provide with the Jesus film as an example of U.S. influence. Could you describe what we can learn from the Jesus film? My brother-in-law actually works with them and goes around the world and records native people who read the translation in their language, and they go about doing this. But the actual message that's portrayed can tell us a lot about the U.S.'s influence across the world and what, and most notably, what's lacking in it. What were some of the things there that would be a little more?
No, I hope there are real serious studies of the Jesus film. I know that Campus Crusade keeps kind of records that are available on the internet and things, and there have been some studies, but this is a very interesting phenomenon. Certainly what the Jesus film represents is a U.S. presence around the world. Now, the question of U.S. influence is maybe just a little bit different. My understanding is that most of the Campus Crusade employees who show the film and work with it in the film are themselves not U.S. citizens. They live where they're working. I'm also aware of some of the violence and reaction that's taking place in a few parts of the world when the film is being showed, but the many, many more instances where there has been joyful acceptance or awareness or appreciation for hearing this kind of message in the language of the people. And for many groups, this is the first modern electronic communication coming from the outside in their mother's tongue, which is that's a really dramatic thing. I one time watched the Jesus film in English, obviously, just to see what it was like, and was not too impressed with it. Cinematographic is a pretty straightforward, dull presentation with, interestingly, some of the bits in the Gospel of Luke cut out that different people would like to have seen included.
Right.
So it is a stripped-down version of the Gospel of Luke. It is produced in America. It's funded by Americans. But when it's shown in the language of the local people, I think we just need a lot more study to what happens and then what are the long-term effects of this kind of entrance of Christian faith into a community under those terms. Not clear to me that this is always American influence, even though it is an American presence.
Hmm. Well, Daryl, what do you think about that, in particular the media or medium in which it's shown? It's automatically going to disqualify itself from certain expressions of Christianity. And another thing you mentioned, Dr. Knowles, that it seems to be lacking some material on the sacraments. It doesn't emphasize church membership, etc., but rather more of an evangelical, in the sense that Daryl would describe it, type of Christianity, the Billy Graham style. You have any thoughts on that, Daryl?
Well, I mean, you know, my vinegary strict Calvinism, as Mark has sometimes called it, is would also stumble over the second commandment on this one. But you know, it seems like you gotta go with the flow in some of these settings when missions is being done or evangelism is being done. We even know from our own folks in OP foreign missions, Orthodox Presbyterian foreign missions, you can't practice always the way you'd like to back on the mission field the way you would at home. So
right, but at the same time, we can never say that the technology is neutral.
Right.
And if we listen to Marshall McLuhan, there's going to be a huge impact on delivering things through video. I don't think anybody necessarily would have a problem with playing an audio recording of a reading of the Gospel of Luke in the indigenous
right.
language.
Right.
But and that's the way my convictions would say, evangelism should proceed through the preached word and the reading of scripture. But I just find it interesting that the presentation of a video, it seems something so tied up with, I don't know, modernity and the American fascination with technology, and that by doing that, we're necessarily going to really shape and change the message as it's delivered across the world. I don't know.
The other thing I was thinking here is, I guess the Hollywood blockbuster, The Passion, and I can't remember mm-hmm. the actor's name.
Jim Caviezel?
Well, but the producer
Mel
Gibson, right. Do you know, Mark, if that's been shown around the world? It probably hasn't translated the way the Jesus film has been. So
it was in Aramaic and Latin, right?
Right.
I don't know. That would be, I know it's been sold a lot of tickets around the world, but whether there have been showings at places out and beyond the theaters, I just don't know.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Which would be an excellent recent question, however.
Well, speaking of Orthodox Presbyterian,
it always comes back to that with us.
I'm just curious, Mark, what you think of denominational identity on the mission field? I mean, you do have denominational labels for the history, especially of the 19th century, but do you think, and this sort of relates to the Protestant Roman Catholic tensions or not, but denominational labels matter anymore? Do you think, is it increasingly the case that they're losing the capacity to convey any kind of identity?
Well, that is a good question, and obviously, in some parts of the world, they do continue to mean something. If you're in Fiji, for example, the Methodists have been in charge, and if you're not a Methodist, you can be beat up sometimes. And that doesn't happen too much with Methodists in North America, but that is a different context. Certainly in South Africa, I read books about the indigenous churches, some of the apostolic and Zion churches, and there was a very clear difference among those black-led, black-originated, black-funded churches between those that took a social witness against apartheid and those that didn't. And even though we're, 15, 20 years beyond the end of apartheid, the differences that were worked out between these groups then still make a difference now. In Japan and Korea, in China, the church groups that and denominations that cooperated with the oppressive regimes have difficulties to this day with those who think that cooperation was inappropriate. But all those are all issues that are different than the ones that formed denominations in the West. I'm impressed with the groups that try to maintain a worldwide organization. And the ones that are the non-Catholics that are most widely spread, interestingly enough, are the groups associated with the Archbishop of Canterbury and then the Seventh-day Adventists, who are in more countries than any group.
That's striking.
I know, Gerald, you've been to Brazil to work with the Presbyterians. I've had some contact with Brazilian Presbyterians, some who are very pleased with the general progress of the gospel. Some are very disappointed because they take traditional Calvinistic convictions very seriously and see these not being promoted by much of the new Christianity. Humans are humans, and the work of the Holy Spirit to encourage people to have a common reliance on Christ goes forward, even as all sorts of reasons, some of them evil, some of them not necessarily evil, lead to divisions within the body of Christ. I'm quite sure that divisions will continue to be important wherever there are Christian people, but whether or not they're traditional Western denominational divisions, I don't know.
But you wouldn't, I mean, it wouldn't be fair to read your book as saying to denominational missionaries from the West, you're not saying to them, lighten up. I mean, you're not saying anything that direct, I don't think anyway, but that's not an implication that you would necessarily want in your book to say to people, you gotta pot your denominational identity down if you're going to play in this world. Or maybe you are saying that. I'm curious.
Well, that is a good question. I mean, and you can take the kind of extreme example. I mean, there's no point exactly in having Southern Baptists in Northern Uganda set up a different order of Baptist churches than set up by, say, the Baptists from Nagaland in India. Even though the Naga Baptists and the Southern Baptists from Louisville, say, really are not on the same page in a lot of things, except it's a few basic Baptist beliefs.
But regardless of that's the case, what you've pointed out, just from the statistics, is that denominational influence seems to be in a sharp decline, and we have this rise in just independent agencies.
Well, this is true for the U.S. too, as you know very well. And I do think, quite apart from what should happen and what's going to happen in the future, I do think that the trajectory of U.S. Christianity post World War II, post 1960s, which in my mind does build on some things that have been there since the colonial period and from the early 1800s. That trajectory is one that does fit a modern world characterized by education, which means that the educated will travel when away from their parents, characterized by increasing personal control over information inflow, characterized by very, very extensive movement of goods, but then also people. So more and more people all over the world don't live where they grew up. So when you have a world characterized in this way, you do have a solvent for a lot of traditions, political traditions, traditions of what people eat, what people wear, as well as in denominational traditions. And I think what's been witnessed in the U.S. with the increasing strength of churches that may have a denominational background but call themselves community church this, community church that, this is a kind of natural response to many, many circumstances in the modern world it's hard for me to say that they're all evil or all good. I mean, they're just cultures evolve and churches are with evolving cultures. Are things lost? Definitely. Are things gained? Definitely. And I think that it's not the historian's job to try to sort these out theologically or in terms of practical moral theology.
Right.
But the trend around the world to sit lighter to denominations, I think, is from one angle, a legitimate and necessary adjustment in order to have the gospel communicate to the world as it really is, and from another angle leads to the loss of some things that have been very important in Christian conception and Christian self-development, and both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think Wendell Berry would have to say about this?
Oh, I don't know.
Wendell Berry would no doubt light up and sit back and have something sardonic to say.
Let me ask you another question, Mark, about the character of missions in the modern world versus medieval or ancient. I seem to recall reading you somewhere say that the transfer of Christianity from the global north to the global south is every bit as significant as the coming of Christianity from the Mediterranean world to other parts of Europe in, say, the early medieval era. That may not be fair, but just go with me if you did write something like that. But
yeah, it certainly sounds familiar. But it's an idea that starts with Andrew Walls and
right. Okay, and I may have read it with Walls first. Sure. But so what would you say is the big difference between missions then and missions now? And are there things that modern missions can learn from ancient or medieval missions, or is it just the case that it's such a different landscape, it's almost impossible to learn?
I think every Christian group that's interested in missionary work today would do very well to study the age of Boniface and the age of Cyril and Methodius and Raymond Lull, and that's a different era, but the people who were moving into new terrain that didn't have a Christian, where there weren't organized churches, and moving out of areas that were not necessarily dominant. I think the standard missionary picture, almost inevitably for people in Europe and North America, is of missionaries going from wealth and with power to places without wealth and without mm-hmm. power. That, I think, is actually just a very brief and though it's recent, but not necessarily the typical missionary pattern. Much more typical would be, for example, Presbyterians going to Korea in the late, well, that's not too bad, going to Korea in the late 19th century, where the U.S. is a world power, but it's Japan and China that controls Korea.
Mm-hmm.
When the Jesuits went to China in the 16th century, the Chinese emperor and his associates, they didn't care what Europe did or didn't think. And in some cultural ways, I think the missionary situation is much more fluid now when there are these other pockets of great strength in other parts of the world, and where serious Christian believers in the West realize the limitations of Christian faith that has come to expression in the West. So yes, I mean, I think in some sense the older missionary work is what's should be studied mm-hmm. most carefully, rather than the late 19th mm-hmm. and early 20th century missionary work.
The other one I was it relates to Presbyterianism in Korea and also East Africa, and just it. I wonder, I mean, of all the denominations that went to those places, since those are the two chapters that you have that are specifically mentioned, the missions work in those parts of the world. How do you think Presbyterians fared in those places compared to other denominations? And I mean, I think it's some people have often wondered. I regularly receive questions about why are so many Koreans Presbyterian, and was there something about Presbyterianism that appealed to Koreans,
right.
Or is there so
simply
obscure,
a timing thing,
right?
Or you know, what are the reasons for that?
Better organization, better people.
Yeah. I would be very loath to speak as any kind of an expert on Korea at all, but. Certainly what exists in the Korean past is situations that are at least in some ways resembling what was like for early Protestants in France and Switzerland.
Hmm.
So just finished writing just a little bit on Sun Ju-keol, who was a leader of the Korean leader of the great Pyongyang revival of 1907, and who was also one of the signatories of the March 1st, 1919 Korean Declaration of Independence, and a pacifist. Well, is his being Presbyterian anything to do with that? And training that he got from Samuel Moffat, the senior, who was the key missionary leader. Well, he didn't have a Kuyperian political theology, but he certainly had an instinct that what transpired in personal religion should have an impact in family and education society. Now, is that distinctly Presbyterian? I don't know. My question about Presbyterianism in Korea is probably relates more to what happened after the Korean War when the fragmentation of the Korean Presbyterian took place. And when you have a consistently fragmenting Presbyterian tradition, is what kind of Presbyterian tradition is that? And I don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
East Africa is interesting to me because of its combination of real serious holiness-type revivals on the Keswick style combined with real strong identification with the Church of England, Church Missionary Society, and Anglicanism in much of East Africa, with some spillover for Presbyterian groups, which are quite a bit smaller than the Church of England. And again, I don't know what how to answer. That's a good question.
Mm-hmm. I've always had that same question myself, wondering why was Presbyterianism so influential over in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a fascinating thing to think about.
But I'm not sure that it's necessarily more influential than, say, Methodism, though. Is that fair, Mark?
Well, there are a lot more Presbyterians, but then you could say, well, are the Presbyterians in Korea acting like Methodists? Well, what are Methodists acting like? The Presbyterians, at least to the extent that I know anything about it in Korea, all participate in the organization of churches through cells.
Yeah.
And the great, as do the Pentecostal churches.
Right.
Now, the extent that the Moravians and the Methodists were the great developers of the cell group organization, you'd say, well, then all the churches in Korea, I think even probably this element in the Catholic churches, but all the churches would share that kind of characteristics. Maybe the Presbyterians are Methodists.
Yeah.
And then Presbyterians that believe that God speaks directly to people and heals people, these look like Pentecostal Presbyterians. So I think Western categories have to be made a little more flexible when looking outside of the West.
We really appreciate you joining us. I want to let everyone...
Well, thank you for attention to the book.
Oh, yeah. And I want to let everyone know you can pick it up, The New Shape of World Christianity. From WTSBooks.com. Also, you can get it elsewhere. It's published by IVP Academic, an excellent book, and one in which you're going to want to pick up and read the arguments in. We've only really touched upon some of the main points there, but you're going to want to read it yourself. You can also get more from Daryl Hart over at oldlife.org. You can find his books online as well. We have a whole list. Actually, I don't know if Daryl actually wants you to go to oldlife.org.
Well, I'm embarrassed in front of Mark, so yeah. that's.
I see.
But Mark anyway. Only knows parts of my life. So.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what it, I'm not sure I know what a podcast is either. I'm not sure that's okay.
And you can, of course, visit us at reformedforum.org and get the show notes and a bibliography there of everything we've spoken about today. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time on Christ the Center.